This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Well, so far the Ethiopian Airlines has announced today that the black box has been found.
That's Gramacho Kabada reporting from Ethiopia on the plane crash that killed all 157 people on board. Details next. Also, the head of the World Health Organization has visited the Ebola Treatment Center in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And the United States has urged African governments to improve their business environments to better attract major American investment. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. The fallout from the crash of the Ethiopian Airlines flight Ethiopian 302 quickly spread across the world. The 157 victims came from 35 countries. They included more than a dozen United Nations employees. Many were flying to Kenya for a major UN environmental meeting where a somber audience observed a moment of silence. The director of the UN in Geneva called it one of the biggest catastrophes the agency had suffered in years. Very quickly, China, the largest purchaser of the new Boeing 737 MAX 8, had its airlines ground the nearly 100 planes in operation. Ethiopia has grounded its 737 MAX planes, as has Indonesia, where the same model of plane crashed in October, killing all 189 people on board. The investigation is likely to focus, at least initially, on the similarities between the crashes. The crash was also a blow to state-owned Ethiopian Airlines, which has expanded to become the continent's largest and best-managed carrier. It has helped turn Addis Ababa into the gateway to Africa and has been part of a reconciliation effort between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Former U.S. President Barack Obama said on Twitter that he and his wife Michelle sent their deepest sympathy to all who knew the victims. The U.S. is offering assistance, including investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board, to help Ethiopian authorities leading the investigation. The plane was delivered to the airline in November. Gramacho Kabada is our reporter in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. I asked him to brief us on the latest.
Well, so far the Ethiopian Airlines has announced today that the black box has been found, and by using that, they will investigate the matter for more. In the morning, they announced that they have decided to ground all fleets of their Boeing B737 MAX. So far, there are big two developments. One is they found the black box, and the other one is they are grounding their Boeing 737 MAX. So those are the two developments so far. Today, the Ethiopian flag has been flying half mast. It was a national mourning day. The feeling in Addis, the mood in Addis has been somber all day. According to people I talked to, took flights today from Addis Ababa Airport to other parts of the world, they think that the premium for the Ethiopian Airlines has been very professional. They have been working hard, even though the crash happened yesterday. And also today, the Ethiopian Pilots Association, the Ethiopian Crew Members Association, held to remember those who perished yesterday, the eight crew members who perished yesterday. So those are the few developments we have today.
Gramacho, 22 UN staff members were among the 157 people killed after flight plummeted into a field outside Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And the airline said passengers from at least 35 countries were on the flight. Could you talk to us a little about that, the international impact?
Those who perished yesterday during that fateful flight were from more than 30 countries all over the world. And the United Nations has lost its members as well because some of its members were flying to Nairobi to attend a United Nations summit on environment. So today, The United Nations also flew its flag half-mast, as a reaction to yesterday's event. And when they began their environmental discussion in Nairobi, they also held a minute silence, just to remember those who died yesterday due to the train crash. But internationally, from the aviation industry, Ethiopian, the aviation industry, specialist, Ethiopian Airlines has got a big support. They talked about Ethiopian Airlines, a very good safety record, and it is one of the leading airlines in Africa, the biggest in Africa as well, and it has a very good record of safety. So I think the international reaction has been, there is a feeling of sadness. People died because of this crash. But also, they were complimentary of the Ethiopian Airlines because of the traffic of safety and security of its passengers. Also, since there were also Canadian citizens aboard on ET302, the Canadian Prime Minister yesterday issued a statement regarding the plane crash. They said there will be Ethiopian government in this difficult time. If I add one thing, the Ethiopian government has also issued a statement to its Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed. He said it was one of the most difficult days, and he extended his condolences for Ethiopia. So the international reaction, in one way, has been a bit sad, a bit, 157 passengers, individuals lost their lives due to their plane crash. So it is a bit sad, but also it has been complimentary to Ethiopian Airlines' history of safety and security in its flights.
That was Gramacho Kabada, a reporter in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa, talking to me about the Ethiopian Airlines plane crash. As reported, the 157 victims came from 35 countries. Kenya had the most at 32, including Hussein Sawala, the former Secretary General of the Football Kenya Federation. He was returning home after working as the match commissioner in an African Championship League in Egypt. Canada lost 18 citizens, including Pius Adasanami, a Nigerian-born professor with Carleton University in Ottawa. Ethiopia had 9 victims, followed by 8 each for China, the United States, and Italy. France and Britain lost 7 people. For the last 2 weeks, tens of thousands of Algerians had been protesting a bid by ailing President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to run for a fifth term. Algerians still remember that Bouteflika promised in 2012 that he would step aside once his third term was up, but has instead held on to power despite a stroke that has left him in a wheelchair. His statement 7 years ago came as the first wave of the Arab Spring had toppled long-term presidents in Tunisia and Egypt. Experts detect some similarities between the Arab Spring in Egypt and the Algerian movement. Anwar Bokaras, a scholar in Carnegie Middle East program, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the protest movement in Algeria.
The protests in Algeria, I mean, certainly they revive memories, what happened in Tunisia and especially Egypt. Like Hosni Mubarak, you've got here an old president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, that doesn't want to give up power. As people take to the streets demanding that the president, who has been infirm, does not seek another term. Like Mubarak and Ben Ali, he responds by saying that, look, yes, I have heard, your calls for reforms. So to appease them, he promises to hold a national conference, after the election. He promises that he would, step down after the election. And again, this is similar to what happened in Egypt and Tunisia. I mean, in their final days, if you remember, both Ben Ali and Mubarak in Egypt, they promised that, look, guys, we're going to form a new government, we're going to work for a transition. But in both cases, it was too little too late. for Mubarak and Ben Ali. So now the Algerian regime seems to be going down a similar path. That said, there are differences. I mean, Algerian history, you know, differs from Egypt, you know, and Tunisia. So that means that it stands apart from those countries. For one, the protests are not necessarily a personal attack against Bouteflika. People do not dislike Bouteflika. It's just it shows people's anger at that opaque, corrupt regime that wants to impose an incapacitated president on Algerians for another fifth term. So many Algerians, especially the young, they feel utterly humiliated for having to endure another term of a person, as you know, who has not been seen in public for ages. So there is anger at the country's secretive leadership of trying to impose Bouteflika on the electorate, of failing to share a country that has wealth, you know, gas, for widespread corruption. So there are similarities, but there are also, you know, differences in there.
Around 1,000 lawyers took to the streets of Algiers arguing that Bouteflika's ill health should disqualify him from the race. Would that work?
The biggest unknown here, really, is whether the military has a contingency plan here. You know, they can come up with a plan to or a path out of the crisis that protects their privileges first, and then occasion a transition that appeases the protesters. You know, that's the biggest unknown. History tells us that they usually do. If they don't, then they're facing a problem.
So what are the possible scenarios for Algeria in light of the continuous, relentless protests?
You know, like what happened in Egypt, I mean, we can see a scenario in which the military, the armed forces, and the security services, I mean, they could be pushed to abandon Bouteflika if public pressure continues to, if it's sustained. So there are fears that the regime will try to, we have seen that again in other cases, by sending pro-regime thugs to create violence as a pretext for the crackdown. So the big question, whether the protests would remain, you know, peaceful, whether the regime is intent to destabilize the protests or not, all big questions, you know, out there. But Bouteflika is, he's done. The biggest question is what the military would do, whether it has a contingency plan. So history tells us that it does. But if it doesn't, it has some dilemmas, you know, that it will have to confront and very, very soon.
That was Anwar Bukars, a scholar in Carnegie's Middle East program, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The United States has urged African governments to improve their business environments to better attract major American investment. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Tibor Nagy, made the comments during a four-nation tour of Africa, as Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
The U.S. diplomat says many American businesses want to invest in Africa, but Tibor Nagy says they first need to see a more positive investment environment.
Which means minimum levels of corruption, fair treatment, honoring contracts, and quite frankly, a good governance environment, because that's what American businesses want.
Nagy made the comments after meeting Friday with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni on the first leg of his four-nation African tour. In December, the U.S. announced its long-awaited Africa policy. The economic focus is on countering China's fast-growing influence on the continent through investment. Critics have accused China of saddling African nations with huge debts that Beijing can use as leverage, so-called debt diplomacy. While China rejects the charge, many African nations point out they have few options for funding large-scale infrastructure projects. And unlike U.S. investments, China's don't come with human rights and good governance requirements. The U.S. says its investment priority for Africa is not just to improve opportunities for U.S. business, but to also safeguard African states' independence. But Ugandan political analyst Bernard Sabiti says in responding to China, the U.S. policy on Africa is becoming more flexible.
The prerogative that the United States has always had to say, if you do not have these governance and human rights benchmarks, then you will not qualify for World Bank loans or our money. I don't think that threat is as effective as it used to be. The countries have learned that you can actually still be pretty brutal, and the United States does not necessarily back away completely.
But Sabiti says African nations still need to do better in addressing good governance, human rights and corruption to attract more and bigger U.S. investments. Assistant Secretary Naj said conflict in Africa is also hindering investment. On Monday, Naj finished a visit to Rwanda, where a diplomatic spat has soured relations with neighboring Uganda. Naj said President Museveni and Rwanda's President Paul Kagame needed to work to resolve the matter.
Both of these countries are very positive forces for the regional environment. Regional security is important for both countries. Both countries obviously have also experienced turbulence with the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo region. So we encourage our friends to discuss any disputes that they have between themselves.
Naj is scheduled on Wednesday to be in the Democratic Republic of Congo to meet with civil society and the controversially elected new government. He plans to discuss strengthening regional stability, good governance and commercial ties, as well as responding to the Ebola outbreak in the country's east. Naj's last stop is next week in Cameroon, where, among others, he will meet with members of the Young African Leadership Initiative. YALI is the U.S. government's signature effort to invest in the next generation of African leaders. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The head of the World Health Organization has visited the Ebola treatment center in the Democratic Republic of the Congo that was attacked by gunmen for the second time, saying the agency remains committed to the fight against the deadly disease. The second attack took place Saturday. Officials said one police officer was killed and a health worker was injured. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus made the visit during a three-day mission to the DRC that included U.S. and WHO officials. In a statement, the WHO said it has asked for and received additional support from the United Nations and local police forces to protect the treatment center. Saturday's attack took place in Botembo, less than a week after the treatment center had reopened after an attack last month. The violence caused the international aid group Doctors Without Borders to halt operations in the city. After Saturday's attack, the center stayed open and received the visiting WHO chief. The WHO statement expressed a regret about the attack but said the group had no choice except to continue serving the people here who are among the most vulnerable in the world. The mayor of Butembo said one of the attackers claimed he was a member of the Mai Mai rebel group. The mayor told the agency Agence France-Presse that the center had been attacked a total of three times. He called the attackers terrorists who wanted to kill the sick. On that Thursday, Doctors Without Borders blamed security forces and what it called the toxic relations with local communities for the violence. The Butembo Center and one in Katawa, that also was attacked recently, had been jointly operated by the Health Ministry and Doctors Without Borders, known as MSF. But after the first attacks, MSF announced it was suspending operations, and the Butembo Center is now run by the Health Ministry, the WHO, and the UN Children's Agency. The outbreak of Ebola in the DRC is the second deadliest, with 561 deaths from almost 900 cases since it was first reported August 1st. Cameroon is celebrating women's rights activist Aisha Dumara Ngatasu after she won France's inaugural Simone Veil Prize. Ngatansu won the prize for helping victims of rape and forced marriage, as Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Applause erupts as hundreds of women's rights activists praise for the 7-year-old Aisa Dumara Ngatansu at the Association for the Fight Against Violence on Women and Girls. The activists are celebrating after France recognized Ngatansu's association for helping victims of rape and forced marriage with the first Simone Veil Prize. French President Emmanuel Macron in Paris gave Ngatansu the $112,000 prize named after the iconic French women's rights activist. Ngatansu says she is dedicating the award to all female victims of violence and forced marriage and survivors of the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram.
La situation a vraiment changé par rapport à l'époque et avant.
She says she is very happy because many people now stand up for their rights. It's unlike past years, she says, when people were scared of denouncing violence against women and girls for fear of being persecuted by men. The award was named in memory of Simone Veil, the person said to be the most responsible for advancing women's legal rights in France during the 20th century. Veil fought in the French Parliament to legalize abortions in 1975. Ngatansu runs an organization that helps victims of rape and forced marriage in Cameroon. She became an activist after she was almost forced into marriage at 11 years old, but escaped from home and continued with her studies. Ngatansu braved numerous threats to save hundreds of girls and women from the same fate. She has in her care 23 girls she rescued from being sex slaves for Boko Haram insurgents. 18-year-old Alima Futsu is one of them. She was forced to marry a suspected Boko Haram fighter, raped, and then abandoned on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. She says from Ngatansu, she learned her rights and will never be indifferent when women and girls suffer. Some men in the far north region of Cameroon still think girls are objects to be used and dumped at will, says Futsu, but she will work hard to make sure such traditional practices of forcing girls and women to marry against their will are stopped. Marie-Thérèse Abena-Ondua is Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment and the Family. She says Ngatansu helped to protect women suffering in the northern part of the country. She says Aïssa Dumara helped women who were abused to find help in legal and social services instituted by the government. She says Cameroon should be proud that it has a woman who has made people to know that they should not treat women and girls inhumanely. The award came just 2 days after Ngatansu organized a mass marriage ceremony for 82 couples to ensure that women in the relationship are protected with legal rights. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an exclusive interview with the Vice President of Malawi, Saulos Chilema. The Malayan politician and VOA's Shaka Sali discuss democracy and the upcoming elections. An in-depth look at Malawi's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Stand up!